Chapter 5 Rue Boissy d'Angla, Paris. She stood on a raised mirrored platform in the middle of a Giambattista Valli's elegantly appointed atelier, staring up at the glittering chandelier, trying to hold still as two seamstresses meticulously pinned up the hem of the delicate tulle skirt that she was modeling. Looking out the window, she could see a little boy holding a red balloon walking down the cobblestone street, and she wondered where he was heading. The man with the string of Baroque pearls around his neck smiled at her. "Bambolina, could you please turn for me?" She twirled around once, and the women surrounding her all oohed and awed.
"J'adore!"
Georgina swooned.
"Oh, Giamba, you were right. Just 2 inches shorter, and look how the skirt comes alive. It's like a flower blooming right before our eyes,"
Wandi cooed.
"Like a pink peony,"
Tatiana gushed.
"I think for this dress, I was inspired by the ranunculus," the designer stated.
"I don't know that flower, but Giamba, you're a genius, an absolute genius,"
Tatiana praised. Georgina walked around the platform, scrutinizing the dress from every angle.
"When Kitty first told me that this couture dress would cost £175,000, I have to confess I was a little surprised. But now, I think it's worth every cent."
"Yes, I think so too,"
Kitty murmured softly, assessing the tea-length gown from its reflection in the rococo mirror, leaning against the wall.
"Giselle? Do you like it?"
"Yes, Mummy,"
the 5-year-old said. She was getting tired of standing there in the dress with the hot spotlight on her, and she wondered when she could get her reward. Mummy had promised her a big ice cream sundae if she would stand very still during her fitting.
"Okay, then,"
Kitty said, looking at Giambattista Valli's assistant.
"We will need 3 of these."
"3?
The tall, gangly assistant looked at Kitty in surprise.
"Of course. I buy everything in 3s for myself and Giselle. We need 1 for each of our closets in Singapore, Shanghai, and Beverly Hills. But this one has to be ready for her birthday party in Singapore on March 1st.
"Of course, Signora Bing,"
Giambattista cut in. "Now, ladies, I hope you don't mind if I leave Luca to show you the new collection. I have to rush off to an appointment with the fashion director of Saks." The women exchanged air kisses with the departing designer. Giselle was sent off with her nanny around the corner to Angelina for ice cream. And as more Veuve Clicquot and Café Crèmes were brought into the showroom, Kitty stretched out on the elegant chaise lounge with a contented sigh. It was only their 2nd day here, and already she was having the time of her life. She had come on this Parisian shopping spree with her Singaporean BFFs, Wandi Megahato Wijawa, Tatiana Savarin, and Georgina Ting. And somehow things were so different on this trip. From the moment she stepped off Trenta, the Boeing 747-81 VIP she had recently refurbished to look exactly like the Shanghai Bordello in a Wong Kar-wai movie. See Wong Kar-wai's The Grandmaster. I much prefer Wong's In the Mood for Love to this film, but the set design was amazing. She was experiencing heretofore unprecedented levels of sucking up. When their motorcade of Rolls Royces arrived at the Peninsula Paris, all of the hotel management stood in a perfect line to greet her at the entrance, and the general manager escorted her up to the impressive Peninsula Suite. When they went to dinner at Le Doyen, the waiters were bowing and scraping so frantically that she thought they were going to break into somersaults. And then during her Chanel couture fittings at Rue Cambon yesterday, none other than Karl Lagerfeld's personal assistant came downstairs with a handwritten note from the great man himself. Kitty knew that all this royal treatment was because she had arrived in Paris this time as Mrs. Jack Bing. She wasn't just the wife of some random billionaire anymore. She was the new wife of China's 2nd richest man. Or 3rd, or 4th. Or 7th richest, depending on which financial tabloid you trust. One of the 10 richest men in the world. To think that Pong Li Li,
the daughter of sanitation workers in Qinghai, had achieved such great heights at the relatively young age of 34,
although she told everyone she was 30. Not that any of this had been easy. She had worked nonstop her entire life to get to this place. Her mother had come from an educated middle-class family, but she had been banished with her family to the countryside during Mao's Great Leap Forward campaign. But she had instilled in Kitty that getting an education was the only way out. All through her youth, Kitty studied extra hard to always be the top in her class, top in her school, top in her state exams, only to see her one chance at a higher education get snatched away when some boy with all the right connections was awarded the only slot to university in their entire district, the slot that was rightfully meant to be hers. But Kitty didn't give up. She kept on fighting, moving first to Shenzhen to work at a KTV bar where she had to do unspeakable things, and then to Hong Kong, landing a bit part in a local soap opera, transforming it into a recurring role after becoming the director's mistress, dating a series of rather inconsequential men until she met Alistair Cheng, that cute, clueless boy who was much too sweet for his own good, going with him to the coup wedding and meeting Bernard Tai, running off to Vegas with Bernard to get married, meeting Jack Bing at Bernard's father's funeral, divorcing Bernard, and finally, at long last, marrying Jack, a man who was truly worthy of all her efforts. And now that she had provided him with his first son, Harvard Bing, born in 2013, she could do anything she damn well pleased. She could fly to Paris on her own private jumbo jet with one French translator, two children, three fabulous girlfriends, all as toned and polished and expensively dressed as she was, and all wives of rich expats in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Four nannies, five personal maids, and six bodyguards, and rent out the entire top floor of the Peninsula Hotel, which she did. She could order the entire Chanel Autumn Hiver Couture collection and have every piece made in triplicate, which she did. She could take a personal guided tour of Versailles with the chief curator, followed by a special al fresco lunch prepared by Yannick Ayeno at Marie Antoinette's Hamlet, which was happening tomorrow thanks to Oliver Sien, who set it all up. If someone wrote a book about her, no one would believe it.
Kitty sipped her champagne and glanced at the ball gowns that were being paraded before her, feeling a little bored. Yes, it was so beautiful, but after the 10th dress, it was all beginning to look the same. Was it possible to overdose on too much beauty? She could buy up the whole collection in her sleep and forget she ever owned any of it. She needed something more. She needed to get out of here and look at some Zambian emeralds. Maybe. Luca recognized the look on Kitty's face. It was the same expression he had seen all too often in some of his most privileged clients. These women who had constant, unlimited access to everything that their hearts ever desired. The heiresses, celebrities, and princesses that had sat in this very spot. He knew he needed to change direction, to shift the energy in the room in order to re-inspire his high-spending client.
Ladies, let me show you something very special that Jiamba has been toiling away at for weeks. Come with me. He pressed against one panel of the boiserie walls, revealing Giambattista's inner sanctum, a hidden workroom that contained only one gown displayed on a mannequin in the middle of the pristine space. This dress was inspired by Gustav Klimt's Adele Blockbauer I. Do you know the painting? It was purchased for $135 million by Ronald Lauder and hangs in the Neue Gallery in New York.
The ladies stared in disbelief at the artistry of the off-the-shoulder ball gown that transformed from ivory tulle at the bodice and into a shimmering gold column, with a cascading train-length skirt embroidered with thousands of gold chips, lapis lazuli, and precious gemstones, painstakingly scattered into a swirling mosaic pattern. It truly looked like a Klimt painting come to life.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable,
Georgina squealed, running one of her long manicured nails over the gem-encrusted bodice.
Ravissement,
Tatiana commented, mistakenly trying to show off her secondary school French.
Combien?
We don't have a price on it yet. It's a special commission that's taken 4 full-time embroiderers 3 months to assemble so far, and we still have weeks of work to go. I would say that this dress, with all the rose gold discs and precious stones, will end up costing more than 2.5 million euros.
Kitty stared at it, her heart suddenly beginning to pound in that delicious way it did whenever she saw something that aroused her.
I want it.
Oh, Madame Bing, I'm so sorry, but this dress is already spoken for.
Luca smiled at her apologetically.
Well, make me another one. I mean, another 3, of course.
I'm afraid we cannot make you this exact dress. Kitty looked at him, not quite comprehending.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
Madame, I hope you will understand. Giamba would be happy to collaborate with you on another dress, in the same spirit, but we cannot replicate this one.
This is a one-of-a-kind piece made for a special client of ours. She is from China also.
I'm not from China. I'm from Singapore,
Kitty declared.
Kitty has only lived part-time in Singapore for 2 years, but like so many other immigrants from mainland China, has taken to referring to it as home.
Who is this special client?
Wandi demanded, her thick mane of Beyoncé-bronzed hair shaking indignantly.
She's a friend of Giamba's, so I only know her by her first name, Colette.
The lady suddenly fell silent, not daring to ask what they wanted to ask. Wandi finally piped up.
Are you referring to Colette Bing?
I'm not sure if that is her surname. Let me check the spec sheet.
He turned over a leaf of paper.
Ah, yes, it is Bing. Une telle coïncidence. Is she related to you, Madame Bing?
Luca asked. Kitty looked like a deer caught in headlights. Was Luca kidding? Surely he must know that Colette was her husband's daughter from his first marriage.
Tatiana quickly jumped in.
No, she's not, but we know of her.
Do we ever?
Wandi sniffed, wondering whether she should tell Luca how Colette's bitch from hell video tirade had gone viral in China, logging more than 36 million views on WeChat alone, making her such a notorious poster child of Fu Er Tai.
Mandarin, for second generation rich. This label is akin to trust fund kids and carries all the scorn and envy it implies.
Bad behavior, that she was forced to flee to London in disgrace. Wandi decided that it was better not to bring it up now.
So this dress is for Colette,
Kitty said, fondling one of the gossamer-like organdy sleeves.
Yes, it's going to be her wedding dress, Luca smiled.
Kitty looked up at him, stunned.
Colette is getting married?
Oh, yes, madam, it's the talk of the town. She's marrying Lucien Montague Scott.
Montague Scott? What does his family do?
Wandi asked, since everything in her universe revolved around being part of an incredibly rich Indonesian family.
I don't know anything about his familia, but I believe he's a lawyer,
Luca said. Tatiana immediately began Googling his name and read aloud from the first link that popped up.
Lucien Montague Scott is one of Britain's new generation of environmental lawyers, a graduate of the Magdalen College.
It's pronounced Magdalen, Georgina corrected.
Magdalen College, Oxford. Lucien sailed across the Pacific on a catamaran made out of 12,500 reclaimed plastic bottles with his friend David Mayer de Rothschild to highlight the problem of global marine pollution. More recently, he has been involved in publicizing the environmental crisis in Indonesia and Borneo.
I think I'm going to fall asleep,
Tatiana scoffed.
He's a charming gentleman. Comes with her to every fitting,
Luca remarked.
I can't imagine why Colette Bing of all people would end up settling for this guy. He's not even an M&A lawyer. His annual salary probably wouldn't even pay for one of her dresses.
I guess she must be desperate to have mixed-race babies,
Georgina said, glancing covertly at Kitty, hoping she wasn't too upset by the news.
Kitty just stood staring at the dress, her expression inscrutable.
Oh, I want to have a beautiful mixed-race baby, too.
Luca, do you know any hot single French counts?
Wandy asked.
I'm sorry, mademoiselle. The only comte I know is married.
Married is fine. I'm married, too, but I would dump my boring hubby if I could get a beautiful half-French baby.
Wandy giggled.
Wandy, careful what you wish for. You never know what sort of baby you'll get,
Tatiana said.
No. If you have a baby with a Caucasian man, you're almost guaranteed it will be attractive. There's a 99% chance it will look like Keanu Reeves. That's why so many Asian women are desperate to find white husbands.
First of all, Keanu isn't half white. He's like three quarters. His mother is only part Hawaiian and his father is American.
Actually, Keanu Reeves was born in Beirut, Lebanon, to an English mother and a father of Hawaiian, Chinese, and English ancestry.
And not to burst your bubble, but I have seen some rather unfortunate-looking mixed-race babies,
Georgina insisted.
Yes, but it's very rare and so tragic when that happens. OMG, did you hear about that man in China who sued his wife because all their children came out looking so ugly? He had purposely married this beautiful woman, but it turns out she'd had tons of plastic surgery before she met him, so the children all looked like her before the surgery.
Wandy giggled.
That story was a lie, Tatiana insisted.
I remember when it went viral, but it turned out the newspaper made up the whole thing and did a fake photo shoot with two models posing with a bunch of ugly kids.
Finding the topic of unattractive children to be appallingly distasteful, Luca tried to steer the conversation in another direction.
I think Monsieur Lucas and Mademoiselle Colette will have beautiful children. She's so pretty, and he's very handsome, you know.
Well, good for them, Kitty said in a merry tone. Now all this baby talk has made me want to look at some daytime outfits for Giselle. Can we do that? And do you have anything fun and unisex I can dress Harvard in?
Oui, madame.
As he headed back into the main showroom, Georgina took him by the arm.
Tell me, Luca, do you live on the second floor?
Without missing a beat, Luca replied with a grin.
Yes, mademoiselle, I think you've seen me before.
Wandy and Tatiana stood by the doorway watching as Kitty lingered for a moment longer by the dress. As she turned to leave, she grabbed the back of the precious Klimt-inspired skirt and gave it one quick forceful tug, ripping it clear down the middle. Chapter 6, 11 Nassim Road, Singapore. Winding through the heart of Bukit Timah, Nassim Road was one of the few long, picturesque streets in Singapore that still retained a feel of graceful, old-world exclusivity with its parade of historic mansions converted into embassies, tropical modern bungalows on crisp, manicured lawns, and stately black-and-white houses left over from the colonial era. Number 11 Nassim Road was a particularly fine example of black-and-white architecture, as it had only changed hands once since it had been built a century ago. Originally commissioned by Bustad & Company, it had been purchased by S.K. Leong in 1918. And every original detail had been preserved and lovingly maintained since then by three generations of Leongs. As Astrid pulled up the long driveway lined with Italian cypresses to the home where she had grown up, the front door opened, and Liet, the majordomo, gestured for Astrid to come down. Astrid frowned. She was picking up her mother to visit Ama at the hospital, and they were already running late for the morning briefing with Professor Un. Astrid left her dark blue Acura in the arched porte-cochere and entered the foyer, bumping into her sister-in-law Kathleen, who was seated on a rosewood stool, lacing up her walking shoes. "Morning, Kat," Astrid greeted. Kathleen looked up at her with a strange expression. "They're still eating. Sure you want to show your face today?" Astrid figured that Kathleen was referring to the Isabel Wu fiasco the other evening. With all the attention focused on her grandmother,
The incident had gone unmentioned by her parents, but she knew that wouldn't last long.
It's now or never, I guess,
Astrid said, bracing herself as she walked toward the breakfast room.
Godspeed, Kathleen said, grabbing her battered Jones the Grocer shopping bag as she went out the front door.
Kathleen Carleon, the wife of Harry and Felicity Leong's eldest son, Henry, takes great pride in her thrift. A partner at Singapore's most esteemed law firm, she takes the public bus to work every day. A granddaughter of the late banking tycoon Ka Chin Kee, she uses a plastic bag from the local neighborhood gourmet grocers to transport her legal briefs when she could well afford to buy Goyard.
Not a nice Goyard leather tote bag. I mean Goyard the company.
Breakfast at Narsim Road was always served in the glassed-in summer porch adjacent to the drawing room, boasting a circular marble-topped teak table from the Dutch Indies, wicker chairs cushioned in whimsical monkey-print chintz, and a profusion of hanging ferns from the Tyersall Park greenhouses. It was one of the loveliest rooms in the house. As Astrid entered, her elder brother Henry gave her a dirty look and got up from the table to leave. He muttered something under his breath as he passed by, but Astrid couldn't make out what he said. She glanced first at her father, who was sitting in his usual wicker chair, methodically slathering a piece of toast with gooey Marmite, and then at her mother, who sat in front of an untouched bowl of porridge, clenching a wadded-up ball of tissue in her hand, her face red and puffy from crying.
"My God, did something happen to Amma?"
Astrid asked in alarm.
"I think the question should be, will you finish your grandmother off with another heart attack when she reads this?"
Felicity chucked a sheet of paper onto the marble-topped table in disgust. Astrid grabbed the sheet and stared at it in dismay. It was a printout from Asia's most popular online gossip column. "Daily Dish from Leonardo Lai. The bewitching heiress at the center of the Isabel Wu Soupgate incident. For those of you who have been following the scalding scandal involving tech billionaire Charlie Wu's wife Isabel that almost caused an international incident between Malaysia and Hong Kong, fasten your seatbelts because boy do I have some shockers for you. We all know that Charlie and Isabel announced their separation in 2013, and informers tell me they've been privately negotiating the terms of their divorce ever since. At stake is a share of the Wu family fortune, their heritage mansion on Peak Road, and custodial rights of their two daughters. But a close friend of Isabel tells me, it's been terribly hard for Isabel. She suffered her recent breakdown because of the emotional stress of the divorce and that other woman involved. Yep, you heard that right. Shocker number one. Daily Dish can now confirm that other woman is none other than Astrid Leong Teo, the model pretty wife of hunkalicious Singaporean venture capitalist Michael Teo, who I think missed his calling as a Calvin Klein underwear model, and mother to a 7-year-old boy, Cassius. Yes, Charlie and Astrid have been having a torrid secret affair for the past 5 years, and in fact, shocker number two, that incredible Tom Koondig design house currently under construction in Shack O that everyone thought was Leo Ming's new private museum is actually going to be Charlie and Astrid's love pad once they can legally shack up. Astrid and Michael Teo are apparently headed to divorce court, too. The stunning seductress Astrid may be an unfamiliar name to Hong Kong readers, but she has an extraordinary backstory. According to my trusted Singapore insider, Astrid is the only daughter of Harry Leong, who officially is the chairman emeritus of the Institute of ASEAN Affairs. Unofficially, he's one of Singapore's most influential political power brokers who, my sources tell me, also happens to head SK Leong Holdings Private Limited, the secretive corporate behemoth that is rumored to own the Bank of Borneo, Selangor Mining, New Malaysia Post, and Palm Core Berhad, one of the world's largest commodity traders. And that's not all. Astrid's mother, Felicity Young, hails from one of Singapore's most pedigreed families.
The Youngs are in their own stratosphere, cousin to the Xians, the Tans, and the Shangs. They are related to practically everybody who's anybody. And Felicity's mother, Shang Sui, owns Tyersal Park, the largest private estate in Singapore, my insider reports. Schooled in London and Paris, Astrid moves in the most rarefied circles and counts among her friends deposed European royals, A-list fashion designers, and celebrity artists. How can Isabel compete with that? Izzy isn't some filthy rich heiress. She has an important career as a legal advocate for Hong Kong's poor and downtrodden, and is busy raising her two daughters, not jet-setting around the world, sitting in the front rows of fashion shows. No wonder she would suffer a breakdown. Of course Charlie would be swept up in the ultra-glamorous life of Astrid. He was seduced by her once before. Which leads us to shocker number three. Back in their college days, Astrid and Charlie were actually engaged. But the union was broken off by her family because the Hong Kong Woos weren't deemed worthy enough by those snooty Singaporeans. It seems like the star-crossed lovers have never gotten over each other, which has led to this big ugly mess. Stay tuned to Daily Dish for more shockers to come. Astrid sank into a chair, trying to collect herself after reading the incendiary column. She was so upset. She didn't even know where to begin. Who sent you this? What does it matter who sent it? The news is everywhere now. Everyone knows your marriage is on the rocks and that you are at fault. Felicity moaned. Come on, Mum. You know it wasn't my fault. You know how careful and discreet I've been for the past couple of years as we've been working out the divorce. This article is nothing but a stream of inaccuracies and lies. When have I ever sat in the front row of any fashion shows? I'm always backstage helping out. Look, they even got Cassian's name wrong. Her mother looked at her accusingly. So, you're denying everything. You're not having an affair with Charlie Wu? Astrid let out a deep sigh. Not for the past 5 years. Charlie and I have only been together for about a year and a half. And this was after I left Michael and Charlie filed for divorce from Isabel. Then it is true. That's why Isabel Wu would go berserk and try to attack you. You broke up her marriage. You broke up her family. Felicity muttered through her tears. Mom, Isabel Wu's marriage to Charlie has never been a happy one. I had nothing to do with their breakup. If you want to know the truth, she has been cheating on him for many years with numerous men. That still doesn't give you any excuse to be Anna Karenina. You're still being unfaithful. You're both still married to other people under the eyes of the law and God. Goodness me, what will Bishop C think when he gets wind of all this? Astrid rolled her eyes. She didn't give a rat's ass what Bishop C thought. So now what? You're going to move into that love pet with Charlie after the divorce and live in sin? That's the other lie. It's not our love pad. Charlie started building that house long before we ever got together. He bought the land after his first separation from Isabel 4 years ago. Astrid took in a deep breath and steeled herself. It was the time to come completely clean with her parents. But I suppose you should know that Charlie and I do intend to get married when our divorces are finalized, and I will likely be spending more of my time in Hong Kong. Felicity looked at her husband in horror, waiting for him to react. You suppose we should know? You're planning to get married this year and you only tell us now? I cannot believe you would actually marry Charlie after all this. Disgraceful. So disgraceful. I really don't see what's so disgraceful about this, Mom. Charlie and I are in love. We've both acted entirely honorably throughout a very difficult time. It's just unfortunate that Isabel had another breakdown, that's all. That breakdown. Those obscene things she said about you in front of the whole world. I have never felt so humiliated in all my life. And those poor ladies. How can I ever look the Sultan of Perawak in the face again? We almost killed his poor mother. Auntie Zara is just fine, Mum. You saw it yourself. Her hijab was so encrusted with diamonds, hardly anything got through. She was more in shock because the laksa wasn't halal.
That Charlie Wu. This is all his fault that our names are being dragged through the mud.
Felicity continued to rage. Astrid sighed in frustration.
I know you've never liked Charlie or his family. That's why you broke us up in the first place all those years ago. But things have changed now, Mum. No one cares about their lineage and all that nonsense anymore. The Wus are no longer considered nouveau riche. They are an establishment family now.
Establishment, my foot! Wu Haolian's father used to sell soy sauce on a bicycle.
That may be how they started out, but they've come a long way since Charlie's grandfather's time. Charlie has created one of the most admired companies in the world. Look at your new phone, the screen, the casing. I'm sure at least half the components are manufactured by Wu Microsystems.
I detest this phone. I never know how to use this stupid thing. I swipe and swipe, and instead of making a phone call, some silly video of an Indian granny singing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star keeps appearing on my screen. I have to ask Lakshmi or Padmi to make every damn call for me.
Felicity was seething.
Well, I'm sorry you still don't know how to use your smartphone, but that has nothing to do with how the Wus are perceived these days. Look how much money Mrs. Wu gives to that church on Barker Road.
Those Wus are frightfully common, and they prove it all the more by giving an obscene amount of money to that church. They think their dirty money can buy their way into heaven.
Astrid just shook her head.
Stop being unreasonable, Mum.
Your mother is not being unreasonable.
Astrid's father cut in, speaking up for the first time that morning.
Look at what's happened. Until today, our family was able to enjoy the privileges of total privacy and anonymity. The Leong name has never appeared in the gossip columns, much less something as silly as this. I don't even know what to call this idiotic internet thing.
And you're blaming Charlie for this?
Astrid shook her head, not seeing her father's logic.
No, I'm blaming you.
Your actions, however unconsciously, have led to this. If you had never gotten entangled with these people, our lives would not now be under the spotlight.
Come on, Dad. You're making a mountain out of a mole.
Shut your mouth and don't interrupt me when I'm talking!
Harry banged his fist on the table, startling both Astrid and her mother. Neither of them could recall the last time he had raised his voice like this.
You have completely exposed yourself, and you have exposed and compromised your family.
For more than 200 years, our business interests have never been scrutinized, but now they will be.
Don't you see how this affects you? I don't think you truly realize how much damage has been done, not just to us, but to your mother's side. The Shangs were mentioned, Tyersal Park was mentioned, and all at the most inopportune time possible when your grandmother is so ill. Tell me how you plan to face Uncle Alfred when he arrives this afternoon.
Astrid was momentarily dumbfounded. She hadn't thought about the repercussions of this gossip site, but she finally said,
I will face Uncle Alfred myself, if that's what you want me to do. I'll explain everything that happened.
Well, you can thank your lucky stars you won't have to. This column and this whole ridiculous website have been taken down.
Astrid looked at her father, momentarily surprised. This article is really gone?
Erased from the face of this planet.
Although enough damage has been done, there's no telling how many people must have read this rubbish before it was taken down.
Well, hopefully the exposure will be minimal. Thanks, Dad. Thank you for doing this.
Astrid muttered in relief.
Oh, I had nothing to do with this. Thank your husband.
Michael had it taken down?
Yes. He bought the company that owns this infernal website and put an end to all of the nonsense. It's probably the first useful thing Michael has ever done to protect you. Which is far more than I can say for Charlie Wu.
Astrid sat back in her chair, feeling her face flush with anger. This was all Michael's doing. He must have alerted her parents to this gossip column in the first place, and of course, he was only too happy to alert them that he'd saved the day.
Hell, he was probably Leonardo Lai's Singapore insider, relishing his chance to sabotage Charlie, to sabotage her.
Chapter 7, 19 West 4th Street, New York. Rachel was in her office suite at New York University, splitting a piece of German chocolate cake from Amy's bread with her suite mate, Sylvia Wong Swartz, when her mother called.
Hey, Mom, how's Panama?
Rachel answered in Mandarin. Her mother was on a two family reunion cruise through the Panama Canal.
I don't know. I haven't left the ship,
Carrie Chu replied.
You guys have been cruising for 4 days now and you haven't docked once?
No, no. The ship has docked, but we've never gotten off.
No one wants to leave the boat. Auntie Jin and Auntie Flora want to get their money's worth, so they just sit and stuff their mouths at the all-you-can-eat buffet all day long. And of course Uncle Ray and Uncle Walt aren't speaking to each other again, so they're both at the casino but at opposite ends. Walt is at the blackjack tables, and supposedly Ray is losing his shirt at Baccarat, but won't stop playing.
Well, Uncle Ray can afford it, Rachel chuckled.
She was so glad she decided to skip this family reunion.
Huh. Yes.
You should see that wife of his. She changes outfits 4 times a day, and every night it's a different ball gown and different jewelry.
I don't know where she thinks she is. This is a cruise ship, not the Oscars.
Auntie Belinda is just doing what she loves, Mom.
She's trying to rub it in all our faces. That's what she's doing.
And of course, your cousin Vivian has to ask her what she's wearing every time, and Belinda always says something like, oh, this one I bought in Toronto at Holt Renfrew, or this is a Liberace I bought it on sale. It was $7,500, marked down to $3,000.
Liberace? I don't think he ever designed clothes, Mom.
You know, that Italian designer, the one that got shot in Miami.
Oh, you mean Versace?
Hiya, Liberace, Versace, is all the same to me. If it's not on sale at Ross Dress for Less, I don't care what the brand is.
Well, I'm sure Auntie Belinda appreciates Vivian's attention. She's clearly the only person on the cruise Auntie Belinda can talk to about high fashion.
Rachel took a bite from her share of the cake.
You and Nick should have come. All your cousins would have enjoyed spending time with you. You know, this is the first holiday Vivian's taken since Ollie was born.
I would have loved to see everyone, Mom, but the dates just didn't work with my teaching schedule.
I couldn't imagine Nick on a cruise ship, though. I'd think he'd jump overboard before the ship even left port.
Ha ha ha! Your husband only likes those private yachts.
No, no, you got it all wrong. He'd much rather rough it than be on some luxury cruise. I could see him on some sort of expedition frigate going to Antarctica, or on a fishing boat in Nova Scotia, but not on any kind of floating palace.
A fishing boat! All these rich kids who grew up with everything just want to live like they are poor. How is Nick anyway?
He's fine, but you know what? His grandmother had a heart attack last week.
Oh, really? Is he going to go back to Singapore?
I don't know, Mom. You know how sensitive he gets about anything having to do with his grandmother.
Nick should go back. You should convince him to go back. This might be his last chance to see the old lady.
Rachel's radar suddenly went off.
Wait a minute.
You've been talking to Nick's mom, haven't you? Carrie Chu paused for a moment too long before saying,
No, we haven't spoken in ages.
Don't lie to me, Mom. Only Eleanor calls Nick's grandmother the old lady.
Hiya, I can't lie to you. You know me too well. Yes, Eleanor called. She's called a few times now and won't leave me alone.
She thinks only you can convince Nick to go home.
I can't talk Nick into doing anything he doesn't want to do. Did you know that Nick was supposed to inherit that house?
Yes, Mom.
I know. I'm the whole reason she cut him out of her will. So don't you see, I'm the last person to tell him to go back?
But his grandmother only has a few weeks to live. If he plays his cards right, he could still get the house.
Jesus, Mom, stop parroting Eleanor Young.
Hiya, no Eleanor.
I'm speaking as your mother. I'm thinking of you. Think about how this house could benefit your life.
Mom, we live in New York. That house is no benefit to us except as one gigantic cleaning nightmare.
I'm not suggesting you should live there. You would sell it.
Think of the windfall you'd have.
Rachel rolled her eyes.
Mom, we're already so fortunate compared to the rest of the planet.
I know. But imagine how your life could change right now if Nick inherits that house. It's worth hundreds of millions, so I'm told. That's like winning the Powerball lottery. This is crazy money. Life-changing money. Enough money so your poor mother doesn't have to work so hard anymore.
Mom, you know you could have retired years ago, but you love what you do. You've been the top property agent in Cupertino 3 years running.
I know, but I just wanted you to think about what it would be like to have that kind of fortune at your fingertips. I want to see all the good things that you and Nick can do with that money. Like that Chinese girl who's married to that Facebook fella. They've given away billions. Think of how proud her parents must be of her.
Rachel looked over at Sylvia, who was leaning back in her chair precariously as she stretched to reach for the cake on the coffee table.
I can't talk about this now, Mom. Sylvia's about to fall over and break her neck.
Call me back. We need to...
Rachel hung up on her mother, just as her friend had scraped a nice bit of chocolate and coconut frosting off with her finger and comfortably returned to her usual seated position.
Way to go, using me as an excuse to get off the phone with your mom.
Sylvia cackled as she licked her finger clean. Rachel smiled.
Sometimes I forget you can speak Mandarin. A lot better than you, banana girl. Sounds like she was in turbo nagging mode.
Yeah, she was fixating on something and wouldn't let it go.
If she's anything like my mom, she's going to call you back tonight and try the guilt angle.
You're probably right, which is why I need to see what Nick is up to for lunch.
A few hours later, Rachel and Nick were seated at their favorite window table at Tea and Sympathy. Nikki Perry, the owner, had been by to share a funny video of Cuthbert, her bulldog, and their lunches had just been placed on the table. It was a snowy January afternoon, and the windows had fogged up inside the cozy restaurant, creating an even more inviting atmosphere for Rachel to enjoy the chicken and leek pie in front of her.
This was the perfect idea. How did you know I was craving TNS for lunch?
Nick asked as he tucked into his usual English bacon, avocado, and tomato sandwich. Taking advantage of his good mood, Rachel got right to the point.
So I spoke to my mom a little earlier? Apparently our mothers have been talking? Oh, God, not the grandchildren talk again. No, this time it was all about you.
Let me guess. My mother has enlisted her help to convince me to return to Singapore.
You're psychic.
Nick rolled his eyes.
My mother is so predictable. You know, I don't think she really cares about my grandmother dying. She's just fixated on me getting Tyersal Park. It's her entire raison d'etre.
Rachel broke the thick golden pastry crust of her chicken pie with a fork and let some of the steam escape. She took her first tentative bite of the piping hot creamy sauce before speaking again.
What I've never really understood is why everyone thinks the house is supposed to go to you. What about your father or your aunts? Don't they have more right to the house?
Nick sighed. Our ma, as you know, is an old-fashioned Chinese woman. She has always favored her son over her daughters. They were all just supposed to marry and be taken care of by their husbands' families while my father got Tyersal Park.
It's this warped mashup of archaic Chinese customs and the British rules of primogeniture.
But that's so unfair, Rachel muttered.
I know, but that's the way things are. And my aunts grew up always knowing they would get the short end of the stick. Mind you, each of them is still going to inherit from Ama's financial holdings, so no one's going to be hurting for cash here.
So then how is it that you suddenly got to be first in line to inherit Tyersal Park?
Nick leaned back in his chair.
Do you remember when Jacqueline Ling came to New York a couple years ago and summoned me to lunch aboard her yacht?
Oh, yeah. She had two Swedish blondes kidnap you in the middle of a lecture, Rachel laughed.
Yes, Jacqueline is Arma's goddaughter, and they've always been extremely close. Jacqueline revealed to me that back in the early 90s, when my father decided to move to Australia pretty much full-time, it so angered my grandmother that she decided to change her will and disinherit him from Tyersall Park. She skipped a generation and made me the heir to the property. But then after I married you, she supposedly changed her will again. Who do you think is currently in her favor to get Tyersall Park?
I honestly have no idea. Maybe Eddie? Maybe one of my cousins in Thailand? Maybe she's going to leave it all to her beloved guava trees. The point is, our Ma uses her fortune to control the family. She's always changing her will according to her latest whim. No one really knows what she's going to do, and at this point, I've stopped caring.
Rachel looked Nick straight in the face.
Here's the thing. I know that you don't care what happens to your grandmother's fortune, but you can't pretend that you don't still care for her. And that's the only reason why I think you should go back now.
Nick stared out of the fogged-up window for a moment, avoiding her eyes.
I don't know. I think part of me is still so angry at her for how she treated you.
Nick, please, don't hold on to this because of me. I forgave your grandmother long ago.
Nick looked at her skeptically. Rachel put her hand on his.
I have, truly. I realized it was a waste of time to be mad at her, because she never really got to know me. She never gave me a chance.
I was this girl who came out of left field and stole her grandson's heart. But the more time passes, I find myself actually feeling grateful toward her now.
Grateful?
Think about it, Nick. If your grandmother hadn't been so resistant to us being together, if she hadn't supported your mom in all her crazy shenanigans, I would never have found my real father. I would have never met Carlton. Can you imagine what my life would be like if I hadn't met them?
Nick softened for a moment at the mention of Rachel's half-brother.
Well, I can imagine what Carlton's life would be like if he'd never met you. He probably would have wrecked a dozen more sports cars by now.
Oh, God, don't even say that. The point I'm trying to make is, I think you need to find some way to forgive your grandmother. Because it's clearly an issue for you, and it's going to keep eating you up inside if you don't. Remember what that radio host Delilah always says? Forgiveness is a gift we give ourselves. If you think you're able to let things go without ever seeing her again, more power to you. I'm not going to force you to get on a plane. But I think you need to see her in person. And I'm guessing she probably really wants to see you too, but, like you, she's too damn proud to admit it.
Nick looked down at his cup of tea. The saucer was emblazoned with an image of Queen Elizabeth II. And seeing the gold patterning at the edge of the porcelain suddenly took him back to a memory of Tyersall Park, of sitting in the ornate 18th-century French pavilion overlooking the Lotus Pond with his grandmother when he was 6 years old. Being taught how to properly pour a cup of tea for a lady, he could remember how heavy the Long Quan Celadon teapot felt in his hands as he carefully lifted it toward the teacup. If the butler doesn't notice that her cup needs to be refilled, you must do it for her. But never lift the cup away from the saucer when pouring, and be sure the spout is turned away from her, his grandmother had instructed. Emerging from the memory, Nick said,
We can't both take off for Singapore at the beginning of the semester.
I wasn't saying we should both go. I think this is a trip you should make on your own. You're on sabbatical right now, and we both know you haven't made much progress on that book you were going to write.
Nick swept his tousled hair off his forehead with both hands with a sigh.
Everything's so perfect in our life right now. Do you really want me to go back to Singapore and open another Pandora's box?
Rachel shook her head in exasperation.
Nick, look around you. The box has been opened. It's been smashed open and gaping at you for the last 4 years.
You need to go back and repair that box. Before it's too late.
Chapter 8. Bombay, India. His nails were like onyx. They were perfectly formed and lightly buffed, so that there was just a hint of sheen. Su Yi had never before seen such beautifully manicured nails on a man, and couldn't help but stare as his fingers counted out rupees for the woman manning a cart piled high with brightly colored candles and strange wax figures, some in the shape of babies, some in the shape of houses, and others resembling arms and legs.
"What are these wax sculptures for?"
Su Yi asked. "People burn them as favors, in the hopes that their prayers will be answered. The babies are for people hoping for a child. The houses are for those that want a new home. And the sick choose a body part that corresponds to their ailment. So if you are looking to heal a broken arm, this is the one you'd get," he said, holding up a wax form of an arm with a clenched fist. "I bought two candles in pale red and blue. They were the closest colors I could find to represent the British flag."
"You must tell me what to do,"
she said hesitantly. "It's very simple. We just place them in the shrine, light them, and say a little prayer." As they walked up the hill with the lovely views of the Arabian Sea, Su Yi glanced at the imposing Gothic facade of Mount Mary Church.
"Are you sure they'll allow me to enter? I'm not Catholic."
"Of course. I'm not Catholic either. But everyone is welcome. If anyone asks us what we're doing, we can tell them that we're lighting candles for Singapore. Everyone is aware of what's happening there right now." Stretching out his arm, he gestured gallantly at the arched front doors. Su Yi stepped into the church sanctuary, feeling self-conscious as her high-heeled shoes echoed against the black and white marble floor. It was her first time inside a Catholic church, and she stared in fascination at the vibrant frescoes on the walls and the words painted in gold script against the majestic arch. "All generations shall call me blessed." The main altar reminded her of those in a Chinese temple, except that instead of a statue of Buddha, there was a beautiful small wooden one of the Virgin Mary, dressed in gold and blue robes, holding an even smaller wooden baby Jesus. Called Moti Moli, or Pearl Mother in Marathi, legend has it that the statue was brought to India in the 16th century by the Jesuits from Portugal, but was stolen by pirates. One day, a fisherman had a dream in which he saw the statue floating in the sea, and this is how it was rediscovered.
"I didn't know there were so many Catholics in India,"
she whispered to him, noticing the worshippers filling up the first 4 to 5 rows of pews, some kneeling in silent prayer. "Bombay was a Portuguese colony during the 16th century, and they converted many Indians. This whole area, Bandra, is the main Catholic neighborhood." Su Yi was impressed.
"You've only been here a few months, but you've come to know the city rather well, haven't you?"
"I like to explore different areas. Mostly I wander around the city out of sheer boredom."
"Has life been that boring?"
"Before you arrived, everything was boring," he said, gazing at her face intently. Su Yi lowered her eyes, feeling her face begin to flush. They walked along the transept until they arrived at a side chapel where hundreds of burning candles flickered. He handed her the red candle and gently guided her hand as she placed its wick onto a flame. The whole ritual seemed strangely romantic.
"There. Now just find an empty slot for your candle, anywhere you like," he said in a hushed voice.
She placed hers on the lowest rack, next to one that was almost burned out. As Su Yi watched the flame begin to brighten, she thought of the island she had been forced to flee. She still wished she could have defied her father and stayed on. She knew she should be feeling grateful rather than angry at her father, especially in light of the latest news. The Jurong Kranji defense line had finally been breached yesterday morning, and invading Japanese soldiers were probably all over Bukit Timah now, swarming her neighborhood as they made their way to the city center. She wondered what was happening at Tyersal Park,
if it had sustained any bomb damage, or whether the troops had discovered and pillaged the place. Sui closed her eyes and chanted a little prayer for everyone who remained at Tyersal Park, and for her cousins, her aunties, and uncles, and her friends, everyone who couldn't get off the island in time. When she opened her eyes, James was standing right in front of her, so close she could feel his warm breath.
"My goodness, you startled me," she gasped.
"Do you wish to confess?" he said, leading her toward a wooden booth.
"I'm not sure. Should I?"
Sui asked, her heart beginning to race. She wasn't sure she wanted to go into the dark box.
"I think it's time."
He opened the lattice work screen door for her. She stepped inside the confession booth hesitantly, surprised by how comfortable the cushion on the seat was as she sat down. It was plush velvet, and it felt all of a sudden like she was seated in the Hispano Suiza that her father had given to her for her 16th birthday. Every time she was driven into town, clusters of people would run after the car in excitement. The Anglos would look in curiously, wondering which dignitary was inside the grand automobile. And she loved seeing their stunned expressions when they realized it was a Chinese girl. Children would try to grab onto the car, while young suitors would attempt to throw roses through the window in the hopes of winning her attention. The window to the confession booth slid open, and she could see that James was sitting on the other side, playing at being the priest.
"Tell me, my child, have you sinned?" he asked.
She didn't want to say anything, but suddenly she felt her lips moving uncontrollably.
"Yes, I have."
"I can't hear you."
"I have sinned. I have sinned against you."
Again, the words just pouring out even as she tried to keep her mouth closed.
"Speak up, dear. Can you hear me?"
"Of course I can hear you. You're sitting 1 foot away from me,"
Sui said, annoyed, as a bright flash of light coming through the lattice work screen suddenly glared into her eyes.
"Can you hear me?"
The voice sounded garbled as it morphed from English into Hokkien. Suddenly, it was all terribly bright, and she was no longer in the confession booth of Mount Mary in Bombay. She was in a hospital room, and her cardiologist was staring down at her.
"Mrs. Young, can you hear me?"
"Yes,"
she murmured weakly.
"Good, good," Professor Un said. "Do you know where you are?"
"Hospital."
"Yes. You're at Mount Elizabeth. You had a cardiac episode, but we've managed to stabilize you, and I'm very happy with the progress you're making. Do you feel any pain?"
"Not really."
"Good. You shouldn't. We have you on a constant dose of hydrocodone, so you should not have to feel any discomfort at all. Now I'm going to send Felicity in. She's very eager to see you."
Felicity entered and tiptoed rather awkwardly to her mother's bedside.
"Oh, Mummy, you're finally awake. They've had you sedated for the past 2 days so that your heart could rest. How are you feeling? You gave us quite a scare."
"Where are Madri and Patravadi?"
"Oh, your lady's maids are right outside. They've been with you all this time, but you haven't known it. Francis only allows one of us in at a time."
"I'm very thirsty."
"Yes, yes, it's this medication they have you on, and the oxygen tube in your nose. It really dries out your throat. Let's get you some water."
Felicity looked around and found a water jug on a side table.
I wonder if this is filtered or from the tap. Oh dear, they only have plastic cups. Do you mind?
I'll have some proper glasses brought up here as soon as possible. I don't understand why there are only plastic cups in here.
I don't know if you can tell, but you're in the royal suite, built for the Brunei royals. We had it specially arranged for you.
But dear me, they need proper cups.
I don't care,
Sui said impatiently.
Felicity poured some water into the cup and brought it over to her mother. She held the cup up to her mother's lips.